Alice! Oh my God, she's dead! She's dead!
Where's the blood from?
It's everywhere, I don't know. Her leg looks broken, everything. Everything's been knocked over. It looks like she's been attacked. Like, she's not breathing, she's actually blue. She put in a complaint in about her ex, and she wrote 101 at the weekend to report that she's trying to get in contact, and he says we're going to do nothing. Now, this is happening.
About who?
Our ex-boyfriend, Harry Dillon.
What was the content of the letter? Was he...
So, pictures of me and him, because he's my ex-boyfriend too, like a notebook that I'd sent him when we were together and a letter.
So, kind of pictures of you and him, notebooks.
Yeah.
Well,
and a letter, yeah.
Okay, what was the nature of it? Was it like threatening or was it harassing?
No, not threatening. It's just saying that he knows I called the police on him and he's had everything confiscated and all he has to himself is a pen and paper and an iPod and explaining why he came down last Friday. It says at the bottom he won't contact, you know, this will be the last I hear from him, but he's said that a lot of times and he never does seem to stop.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard, criminal behavioral analyst and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim is my colleague. And I'm very honored to be here today.
Because we have a very special guest.
Very special guest who's joining us from Leicestershire.
Hi there, Laura. Yes, I'm Clive Ruggles. I'm a professor from Leicester University in England. But my reason for being here today is because I'm the dad of Alice Ruggles, and that's what this is all about.
It is. This is a really important podcast. And we actually decided to talk with Clive to mark National Stalking Awareness Week, which begins in the UK on April the 16th. Mm. And I have to say, I was privileged to coordinate the very first one in conjunction with the Home Office and the Chief Police Officers Association, and that was in 2011. And now National Stalking Awareness Week is a regular fixture in the UK diaries, and so there'll be events going on all around the country, and we felt it was really important to talk about Alice. So do you want to tell us a little bit about who Alice was, Clive?
Sure. Well, let me start with a little anecdote. There were so many anecdotes. This is one of my favourite ones. It's December a few years ago, and I was waiting for a wine box because we need the wine for Christmas. And I was getting agitated because it was late arriving. And I'm strutting up and down the living room. And then there's a phone call. I answer it. And it's a lady from the wine company who says, we hope you're enjoying your wine. And I said, well, it hasn't come yet. She said, yes, we delivered it about 20 minutes ago. No, you didn't, I said. We live in a little village which doesn't have numbers on the house, it just has names. So people quite often get them confused. So I said, you sure you got the right house? Yes, yes, that's right. Right house name and everything. We described the house. Yes, we did. I said, you must have delivered it from the wrong house. Sorry, can you please go away and check? So off she goes off the line. And 20 minutes later, all that time, still no wine. And then the phone rings again. We hope you're enjoying your wine, she says. And we go through this all again with me getting more and more agitated. And I'm having trouble understanding her because she has this quite strong accent. I don't know what sort of accent it was, but I could hardly understand her. But in the end, this goes on and we go round and round. And after about half an hour and three phone calls, and I'm threatening to phone the company and so on. And all of a sudden, the door from the other front room opens. And a very sheepish-looking Alice, who must have been about 18, 19 at the time, comes out. with her mobile phone, which hadn't, for some reason I hadn't realised this was, and it was Alice on the phone pretending to be this lady from the.
I love it.
And she decided this little prank had gone far enough at this point, and that Dad was really about to explode. So she came out and confessed, and that was absolutely typical. There was never a dull moment with her. She was just full of fun and enjoyment.
But where was the wine?
Yeah.
Oh well, actually, funny enough, the wine actually arrived. After this all finished, it would have gone wrong completely if it arrived in the middle of it for her. But anyway, yes.
So she hadn't been drinking it next door.
We used to have these family Christmases. Alice's birthday was Christmas Eve, and my wife's birthday, Sue, hers was on Boxing Day. So we'd have these 3-day-long Christmas celebrations, and we'd always do Chinese on Christmas Eve, Alice's birthday, because that's what she loved. And so we were always close-knit, and this went on from when she was a child right through to when they were all adults. Alice was the third of our four children, and... we had these wonderful family times, and also we had wonderful fun on the family WhatsApp. Alice's wit was just so sharp, and so whatever we'd be discussing on this family WhatsApp group, she'd be in there with the joke, like she would in real life. You know, if you were feeling fed up, if Alice came in, she just had this knack of making you feel happy and saying some silly joke or something. And all her friends found that later. So, yeah, that was Alice. You know, I tell you all the standard thing. She loved fencing. That was her sport. I think she did that because it was the only sport that she could find that her elder sister Emma wasn't better at. But she really got on with it, and she ended up at the regional and even winning some national competitions in fencing. So she was really, really strong with that. And I think the reason she eventually went to Northumbria University, which is in Newcastle in northeast England, was because they had a good fencing team. But having got there, she discovered that she loved Newcastle as a place, and so after she graduated, she stayed there, and that became her home. And that was where she got her first pub job for a year until she found her first real job. And she worked for Sky, who were really nice employers, and there was a great atmosphere in the workplace. And within a few months of getting there, they discovered that she had greater talents than just answering the phones. And they ended up creating a job for her. But they seemed to have had such fun. And, you know, after it all happened, then we had an album that the people, all our colleagues from Newcastle, brought down, and just full of these ridiculous anecdotes from her couple of years at Sky. So she loved Newcastle. She loved all the people she worked with. It was good.
The way that your face lights up when you talk about her is really amazing. I mean, it's obvious that your love for her unbounded, and we're really, really sorry. And our condolences go out to you and Sue and
the rest of the family, her brothers and sister Emma. I mean, it was, you know, October the 12th, 2016 was when your world fell apart.
Yeah, I can't. Well, it fell apart for Sue and me in the early hours of the next morning, of course. We knew nothing about it on the day. And that dreadful knock on the door at 2 a.m. And the first thing I was aware of it was the dog barking and barking downstairs. She sometimes barks in that she hears something. And then there was a knock on the door. And I thought, oh, for goodness sake. And it persisted. And after a while, I got up and, you know, there's the two policemen on the doorstep. Can we come in, please? And you know it's something horrible. You know, it's exactly the same as it would be in a movie, you know. And can we come in? Is your wife in? Can you get her as well? Can you sit down? You know, it's something dreadful. And the moment they said, it's Alice, you know, you cannot describe. And, so it was weird. They told us. And, of course, it was the local police. It wasn't the people in Newcastle. We're 150 miles away from Newcastle. So it was the local police that came and told. And then they went. And so there was Sue and I sitting in the kitchen at 2:30 in the morning thinking, what do we do? You know, the police support did kick in, but it didn't kick in until a few hours later and basically came from Newcastle. So we looked at each other and we ended up going driving. We decided we'd better let everyone know before they found out by some other means. So we actually went to where Nick lives, which is not many miles away, woke him up at 4 a.m. That's our eldest son. And then we drove up to Sheffield, which is like 50 miles away. And our younger son, Patrick, is a student there, told him. And by that time, the army, Emma is in the army, and she was posted in Germany. The army, of course, are very good at this sort of thing, and they told her and had her on a plane, and we actually then went and collected Emma from the airport, and we got home with Emma 10 a.m. Well, you can imagine the rest. You won't be far off, but yeah, wow,
just so, yeah, devastating.
It must be so incredibly surreal at the same time. Like, is this really happening? And then having to tell the story over and over again to each family member.
Yeah, it's almost as if it's happening to someone else half the time, you know. So this was something I found those early days and weeks, you know, especially talking about it, that you almost sort of pull away from it and you're talking about something almost academically, and then it hits you again. And it just hits you in waves. And no, this is actually our Alice we're talking about. And then it hits you. And wow. Yeah.
Takes a long time to sink in. And so what happened next, Clive, in terms of the police told you a little bit about what happened to her, or were they still trying to work out?
Oh, no. The what happened was that, well, when the police arrived in the middle of the night, they told us they'd already apprehended someone. At which point we said, is it Harry Dillon? We already knew who it was. And Trimmer Dillon, we all knew him as Harry. And so we already knew at that point. And then they said, yeah, that's his name. And the next day, when Castle got in touch with us, then we started to, we made contact with the police up there. And the lady in charge of the operation, Lisa Theaker, then arranged to see us on the day after. So on the, what would be the 14th now, was the day when we all drove up to Newcastle. It's like a 4-hour drive for us. And went up, we spoke to Lisa, because we saw Alice and everything, we did all that. So that was all on 2 days later. But that was also the day that Lisa broke it to us that by the purest coincidence, her team were being filmed by a documentary crew from ITV. And this was for a series of programs they were intending to do about how the police solve serious crimes, and how their theme was at the first hour when the call comes in, and how they deal with things after that. But and they'd been filming Lisa and her crew about this, and Alice's call came in, or the news of it came in while they were being filmed, and the result was, this was so much bigger than anything else they were filming, that they ended up making a documentary just about Alice, and that actually went out on the anniversary of the day it happened last October. So we actually have, there was actually a big ITV documentary about the police operation after it had all happened. But yeah, they apprehended him. They were told right away who it was, and they apprehended him before midnight. But I can tell you about that as well later.
Right. So Lisa was the DCI, the Detective Chief Inspector, wasn't she, in charge of the investigation into Alice's murder?
Yes, Lisa. Yeah, so she was, and so the program was very much about her investigation there. The call came in. Basically, well, do you want me to talk about what happened on the day first, or shall we?
Yeah. I was going to just say that the for our listeners, the documentary is called An Hour to Catch a Killer.
Yeah.
It was hosted by Sir Trevor MacDonald, wasn't it? If I recall correctly.
That's right. Yeah.
And it really was about that golden hour, as we call it in the UK, in an investigation where you know, the golden hour is the most critical to secure evidence. So what you were seeing, if people look at that particular documentary, it's a fly on the wall watching the team. But as you said, Clive, and I remember you and I talking about this, because I've had the pleasure of meeting you and the real honour a number of occasions now, and talking about Alice, for really the learning of trying to understand what went on previously. So, you know, the calls to the police and who did what. And but this particular programme wasn't about that. It really concentrated on the investigation in terms of who did this and arresting him. And of course, that all happened very quickly, didn't it? And in fact, you and Sue believed it to be Harry or Treeman. You believed it to be him straight away. So do you want to tell us why you believed it to be him and just some of the things that were happening previously?
Well, yes, let's start the story from the beginning. Alice went on holiday with a girlfriend to Sri Lanka, and this was in October of 2015. And while she was there, her friend she was introduced on the social media to a friend, this guy who was a friend of hers that she'd known since college days. And this guy, Treeman Dhillon, he was actually in the army. He was stationed in Afghanistan at the time. So they were introduced on the social media. And in fact, they got chatting and got to know each other quite a bit, I think, on the social media in that time. And so they decided to meet, and they actually met in January of 2016 for 2 weeks. And he came and he stayed with Alice in Newcastle. And then she went up and stayed with him at his barracks, which was up near Edinburgh, 100 miles further north in Scotland. Yeah. So they had these 2 weeks, where he looked after and flattered her, and she had a wonderful time. And that was where the relationship really started. And then he went back off to Afghanistan for his last couple of months of his tour out there. And then he came back for good in April. The first time we saw him, they came to visit us one weekend. It was a bank holiday in early May, and we saw them a couple of times. And so, you know, when we first met him, I wasn't deeply uncomfortable about him. I could tell he was the sort of lad who would tell me the sorts of things he wanted me to hear as a dad, you know, but I can envisage, you know, a dozen boyfriends that Alice might have brought home. I'd have thought, don't like him. It would have been fine. But, you know, there was nothing that made you think, you know, be wary of this guy in that, which is, you know, we can see things in retrospect, but retrospect's a fine thing. So yes, they went out for the 2 or 3 months and in April and May, but things started to get a bit strange because and a few things we were aware of. She fell out with all the guys in the house that she was sharing with 3 or 4 other guys, and she sort of fell out with them all, and she started falling out with her friends, and in retrospect, we now know, a lot of it came out of the trial, that he was actually sort of gradually isolating her from different friends. And he was playing on these relationships and actually helping this along and making her gradually more and more dependent on him. And of course, you know, when you say that sort of thing, you think, well, if this is someone who's kind of vulnerable, who's, you know, doesn't understand what's going on. Well, Alice wasn't like that. She was, you know, she was a socialite. She knew what she was doing. And yet she was really unaware of at the time of what was happening to her. And this went on until May, June. And then early July, they actually came and joined us in Cornwall for a week. Another family tradition was we had these annual holidays, and we spent a week. And a lot of things, again, Alice, they didn't, you know, they were never apart really, but Alice seemed to be a lot less happy about things at that stage. You know, she was sort of unhappy in herself, and she'd lost weight, and she'd lost confidence and everything. And, you know, she was telling Sue and others that she'd lost friends and so on. And it actually all came to a head very shortly after that, because she was contacted by a girl who had been contacted by Treeman on Tinder and one of these sites, and he'd been basically dating other girls under different names and things, and she found out from one of them this was happening, and so she broke it off, And it was at that point that this sort of elements of control, that's when the stalking kicked in. That was when he started bombarding her with emails, phone messages, and he'd already hacked into her Facebook account. She had to shut it down and start up a new one. So at this stage, this is where it all became stalking, and this went on for July and August. And she'd respond occasionally to say, ask him to stay away and this sort of thing. And it was a mixture of sort of emotional blackmail. He said, I can't live without you sort of stuff. And also rather more sort of intimidating stuff mixed in. And then things came to a head on, it was actually the 30th of September. By this time, she was bolting the door and the sort of thing of her house. She lived in this a ground floor flat in Gateshead, which is south of the river, just across the river from Newcastle. And there was a knock on her door early evening, and she was worried and she peeped out and there was no one to be seen. And this happened two or three times during the evening. And then she'd gone to bed, and around midnight sometime, there's a knock on her window. Now, you can access a window from outside. If you jump over the wall, you can get in. And when she opened the curtains, there was Dylan. There was a vase of flowers, and there were some chocolates. And and he was just backing off, his hands up in the air like that, saying, making the gestures, saying, okay, I'm going, I'm just leaving this. And then he then started phoning her. And I mean, one of the phone calls is I did this because I love you sort of stuff. And then the other one is full of all this. I'm not going to kill you. Don't worry. You might think I'm going to kill you, but I'm not, you know, and all this. And he goes on about not killing her. I think he says it, I think it's 11 times in the message, something like that.
That's right. I remember listening to that message. And it's very covert. It's very, it's implied as a threat, isn't it? I'm not thinking of killing you. I'm not going to kill you. And you're right. I counted, I think it was in excess of 10 times that he makes that point, which is clearly something in his head at that time.
Veiled threat is the right word, yeah. So at that point, I mean, she had someone friend came round to stay with her, and she was persuaded by that friend to call the police. And so that was the occasion when she called the police. And that phone call is also recorded. It's out there. And she explains, of course, she's so polite on the phone. Makes you cry listening to her. You know, you can hear, you know, just having a few problems. I'm a bit concerned, you know, this sort of thing. And she describes it. And the officer on the other end was so comforting to her. And I mean, he said, well, there's a few things you can do. You can go to a solicitor and get an injunction. Now, of course, that's not actually good advice. But I mean, how can someone in Alice's position, they've got no money, go to a solicitor and it would take time and so on? And then he said, or we could issue a PIN, a police information notice. And if we do that, then he won't, then if he contacts you or comes near you again, you'll get arrested. What do you want? And she said, I think I'll go for that option. And so they came round and they did the assessment and issued a PIN. Well, I say that, but the thing was that he was in an army barracks up in Edinburgh. So actually, the notice of this PIN was delivered, I don't think even by the military police, but just by a superior officer. He was told about this. But Alice then, knowing or believing that she was protected, then I think people at work said she suddenly got more buoyant and she was happier and she felt much better, relieved almost. And that went on for a few days until the 7th of October, just a week later, when a parcel arrives from him. And it's got this message saying, oh, I'm just sending you all this stuff. And he gives it, again, it's this emotional stuff. He said, well, they've taken away my phone, they've taken away my laptop, all this sort of thing, which is actually a lie. We know it was a lie. So he's trying to pretend to her that he's upset, but he's also in there as this sort of bit of a showing that he's not very happy that she's done this against him. And at that point, I mean, I think this is one of the real dangers of issuing something like that, that the person, I mean, stalking is all about obsession. It's all about control. And when someone in that position knows that the person's got the police order against them, they feel they're losing control. And it's a challenge to them. And that sort of ups the ante. And that makes it, it can make it more dangerous. In fact, a senior police officer I was speaking to a few weeks ago actually said, do you know, there's not many situations in which we, the police, can actually make things worse. And he said, well, one of them is a kidnap situation. It's obvious, he said. But actually, stalking is another one, because if you take an action like that, but then you don't follow it up, and then you're actually you're challenging the obsession, challenging the control. And that's going to make that person all the more dangerous. And you're making a bad situation worse. Well, anyway, after that, Alice contacts the police again. There's a 101 number, non-urgent number. She couldn't get through originally. Someone calls her back. We don't have a recording of that second phone call. It wasn't from the same police officer, because he was on 4 days leave. And the as we understand from what Alice told Sue and what Alice told her sister Emma, this second police officer says, well, you know, almost surprised that she'd actually bothered to call. So, well, what do you want us to do about it? Arrest him?
Which is the worst thing you can ever say.
And so, you know, suddenly Alice is, she thought that he was just going to be arrested if he did anything, contacted her. And she was suddenly made to feel that actually she was almost wasting police time by suggesting it. And so she said no. And she, I mean, at one level, all she wanted was for him to go away. She didn't really want him to get into trouble. So she said no, and that was on the 7th. But of course, that shattered her feeling of security, for one thing. We know that, we learned this at the trial, he drove all the way down from Edinburgh to photograph the back windows. He's got photos on his phone. He was sizing up the joint quite clearly. And on the 12th, he came back for the last time. One of the things that's just incredibly fortunate for the investigation was that a car had drawn up at the house next door, and the webcams on the cars keep going for about 2 minutes after the engine switched off. And the webcam on this car caught Alice, who was being driven home by a colleague from work, stopping outside her house and going into the house. And you can see that on the documentary, that just pure chance that they caught that. So they know when she went in, and she was texting away and WhatsApping with Mike. She'd got to know this new guy, Mike, who was a lovely guy. We didn't know, we've only met him since, but couldn't ask for a nicer guy. And it was actually a colleague of Emma's, and they got introduced through Emma. And they were WhatsApping each other, and he was planning to come over from Germany to see her at the weekend and everything. And, you know, in the middle of the WhatsApp conversation, her messages suddenly stopped. That was like about 6:05. And then Maxine, who was a flatmaker, a colleague from Sky, got back to the flat, and she just had this idea something was wrong. She was and she couldn't get in the front door because it was triple locked, and she went round the back and climbed in, and that's when she found her. And it was already too late by then.
And that terrible phone call that Maxine made, and again, I remember listening to it and just how distressed she was finding her friend. I think she said that, you know, her skin was blue and she knew that she wasn't breathing, and just how traumatic to get into your home and see your best friend lying on the floor.
Oh, well, and the bit you don't hear just after that recording that's on the programme is that she screams out Dylan's name, because she was in no doubt who had done it. So, you know, she was screaming out his name. And I think all that was a help. I mean, it's in the documentary, but they went after him. He'd driven back to the barracks, and he'd actually largely cleaned up by the, you know, himself. He'd washed and cleaned his clothes by the time they caught him, but there was enough evidence he had a wristband and other things, so they caught him trying to get out of the barracks again. I found he's trying to scale a wall to get out of the barracks without going through without being signed out. We've since been in touch with another girl who's lived at the time up in Glasgow or Edinburgh, I'm not sure. But no, I think she lived in Perth, which is even further north. And he'd been texting this girl from his car while he waited for Alice to come back. And when he got back in his car, he texted her again because he was going to go drive up to see her. And he just coolly texted that he was going to be a bit late. And then he drove back. And so we believe his intention was to go up and see this other girl. You can imagine what she felt when she found this out a few weeks later.
What kind of person does that, Jim and Laura?
It sounds like psychopathic behavior or schizophrenic behavior. It's
all about
people.
Control. Yeah. Yeah, very psychopathic tendencies. I mean, we'll talk about what he said at court as well, because, of course, he came up with a totally different version of events, didn't he?
I mean, he was caught out even when they arrested him because he didn't know that there was any evidence that he'd been there. Yeah, they actually showed this on the documentary. So while he was in the police station, he changed his story when they presented him with the evidence they knew he'd been there. During the 6 months before the trial, he changed his story another two or three times. So by the time he got into court, I mean, you couldn't help feeling everyone must have known, because already he'd had three or four different stories. He was just inventing a story to fit the facts as best he could. And he was trying to, by the time he got to court, he was trying to argue that she'd attacked him. You know, he'd admitted that he'd gone in there. And so, yes, in the court, we obviously had to sit through all the forensic evidence and everything. But then we had to sit through his detailed explanation of what had happened, with him trying to explain in his own twisted way what had happened. And, you feel that, well, you know that these people are emotionless. You've seen this on other cases and things. But the thing that struck us, I think, was just how clinical, how sort of academic almost he was about it. And he would sit. He was actually arguing with the barrister at some point, saying, no. If you look at, you know, this page on this such and such, it says this, you know, and that sort of level. And you couldn't help believing, you know, that everyone in that courtroom knew that he was just spinning this. And no one in that courtroom could have believed a word of it. But you still worry, of course. You're there, and you still worry that some technicality is going to get him off or something, you know. So even though you can't, you have to sit through all this stuff, and you can't believe that anyone is actually believing it, but you're still worried. Until that verdict comes in, you're still worried.
That's right. And he said that he was trying to protect himself from Alice, and also trying to protect her from herself. And yet she fought for her life. The forensics, the evidence showed completely differently to what he was saying. And his control and manipulation and his obsessive behaviour, I mean, you saw it in court, you know, right up to the end. It would come as no surprise to Jim. But devastating, putting you all through that in terms of him.
The most extraordinary thing I felt was that he hadn't even worked out that he should appear emotional about her. You know, because it was the very first thing that the prosecution barrister fired at him was that, well, you don't seem to be at all upset. She was meant to be your girlfriend. She meant this girl you loved, you know, and yet you're clearly not upset. And he hadn't actually worked out that he should try and pretend he was upset.
Well, that's another indicator that of psychopathy, because, you know, they don't feel emotions. They have no human empathy. And therefore, it's only the smart ones who see it, recognize it in others, and mimic it. And that makes them even more dangerous. But somebody like him, he doesn't even realize that it has any significance to others, because he has no experience of that in his life.
So no empathy, no remorse, no responsibility taking. I mean, he ticked most of the key behaviours in the psychopathy checklist, just in terms of an indirect assessment of how he behaved.
come round the back, knocked on my bedroom window at the back of my flat, ground floor flat. And he stood outside and he's like left some flowers and chocolates on the like outside windowsill, and like he walked off. He's not done anything, but I'm concerned. I've been putting off, like my friends have been telling me to call the police. I've been putting it off, but I just feel a bit like shaken up tonight. So
well, it can be classed as harassment.
Yeah,
which is a crime.
Yeah.
I mean, perhaps, Clive, we can just go back to Alice's calls to the police and, you know, the action or lack of that was taken. Yeah. Because for our listeners, they probably don't know what a police information notice is, the PIN that we've been trying to get done away with for many years, because a piece of paper does not protect a victim from a stalker, someone who is obsessed and someone who is fixated and somebody who is trying to take control. And I've always said that a piece of paper will never protect that victim because it is just a piece of paper. And so Alice thinking that this piece of paper is going to protect her lulled her into a false sense of security, which it's my opinion should never have happened, because actually there were many behaviours where he could have been arrested for the crime of stalking. And we've talked about this, haven't we? Stalking's a criminal offence. It came in 2012, and you need two behaviours or more. Well, Harry Dillon, had called her 290 times in a six-week period, hadn't he? And those 290 times, those calls, some of them were recorded, and the text messages and the appearing at her property. I believe it was in excess of three times he actually turned up at her property, yep, uninvited, unannounced, knocking on the window, scaring the bejesus out of Alice to the point that she didn't feel safe in her own home. And that's why she was calling the police.
That's right. There was no history of violence before. He hadn't been violent to her before that. But again, as that was explained to us, this is about control and obsession. And if the control can be achieved in other ways, you don't need the violence. But when that control is taken away, I don't know if that accords with you, but
well, it does. I mean, coercive control, that's, and as you know, and again, that law change was something that I campaigned for with other people to ensure that the behaviour in a relationship, those coercively controlling tactics, the isolation, you know, inserting yourself in the victim's relationships, the criticising constantly. And, you know, I learned from you and from Sue and from some of her friends, he was criticising her nose and the hairs on her arms and making her feel so self-conscious about who she was and about her weight. And that's why her personality started to change. And he was trying to isolate her away from her friends and her family, sending her all these terrible messages and at times putting her on a pedestal too. He would fluctuate between these things,
right,
wouldn't he?
Right.
And so this kind of love bombing, as we call it, meant that she was constantly unseated and didn't know where she was with him. But she was trying to get on with her life. She'd started a new relationship with Mike, and he would not accept that the relationship was over. And that's why he was bombarding her post-separation. But the behaviours pre-separation, that's now a crime, and we would call that coercive control. But the problem is on separation, when somebody is trying to leave that abusive individual, then it can escalate. And of course, the same behaviours then get amplified, and that's what we then call the stalking behaviours. And of course, in Alice's case, sadly, there were multiple threats made. So some of the threats were pictures that had been taken of her, that he said he was going to publish
them.
Right. Didn't he? Which put the fear
of
God into her. That's how he was
surreptitiously taken those and then threatened her with them. That's right.
That's right. Trying to control her again. And he'd threatened her in the phone call saying, I'm not going to kill you. But again, in her mind, she got that message.
It's a veiled threat. It's a threat, all right. It's a veiled one. Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned these PINs, these police information notices. I mean, the big problem with them is they actually mean nothing, and that the officer was wrong to say that that she would be arrested if he broke it, because there is actually no recourse to any action if one of those is broken.
Really?
And
is it like a
restraining order, or
it's a piece of paper that was written, and you know it wasn't meant to replace restraining orders or injunctions. It was really for the 1% of cases where perhaps somebody didn't realise their behaviour was causing alarm and distress and putting someone in fear. Now, that's about 1% of cases. The problem that happened in the UK was it became a go-to tactic, that if someone like Alice called up and she's acquiescing, which actually about 80% of victims do, they call up and they say, it might be something, it might be nothing, this is going on, he's hacking my Facebook, he's making me feel really uncomfortable, he's coming to my house. And then somebody might say, a police officer might say, well, has he actually threatened you? And then, like in Alice's case, well, no, there's been no overt threat. Oh, okay, well, then we can write him a letter and just say, if he does it again, we will arrest him.
Yeah, which is, in fact, yeah, given you're not going to do that, it's making things actually worse, because it's making him realise that his control is being challenged. So that ups the ante. But if he realises that it's an empty threat, then clearly it's just making things worse.
Over the hornet's nest, Clive, you know, and you've got to be prepared that if you kick it over and you haven't got the right protective gear on, yep, then, you know, you're going to have some serious repercussions. But equally, if somebody broke into your house and burgled you and, you know, or robbed you and you went to the police, well, how would you feel if the police turn around and said, well, we can write a letter to John James and we can say to him, if he does it again, we're going to arrest him? I mean, why is that appropriate?
Ridiculous. And going back to the crime of stalking, it's the police's job to recognize the behaviors that violate the law, not the victims.
I think one of the problems here is that there's been movement towards trying to give the victim a voice. So the police are trying to let the victim speak, and they're trying to listen to that. The problem is that that's just been completely mishandled in this sort of situation, because the victim does not realize what sort of danger they're in. Alice had no idea how dangerous this could be. I mean, we had no idea on the basis of what we knew either. And the police have to be the experts. No one should be asked what do you want us to do about it. The police have to be the experts, and that's a big police training issue. Because yes, I sympathise with the fact that the guy, lady answering the phone, it may be the 200th call that's come in. They're under a lot of pressure. They're dealing with whole range of different people, but you have to train that frontline officer enough to recognise that there are signs of stalking, that's got to be referred on for potentially some urgent action to the specialist, and there need to be the specialists there in the force that know where to take it. But you've got to train that frontline officer to recognise it. And, of course, the person may not be giving them all the right sort of information, so they have got to delve a bit.
Right. They have to ask the questions. If they don't ask the questions, the right questions, and then document it in the right way, and then send that information to the experts so that they can make an assessment, then what are they doing? What is the purpose of having that phone line to call in for emergencies when they're not actually addressing the emergency that's about to happen?
That's right, and we've created the best practice. And in fact, Clive, you came to Paladin's first national stalking, which was an evidence-based best practice conference. And, you know, we've been creating the right questions for police and other agencies. So not just the police, partner agencies as a specialist service to ask those questions. So it is very frustrating that those things aren't being promulgated. And it's always about asking those right questions. And the victim's voice is about hearing, you know, the victim and believing them and taking them seriously. But they have to concentrate on the perpetrator, you know, yes, the behaviours of that perpetrator, and also refer victims to the specialist services.
That's right. They have to manage the risk. And that involves protecting the victim and managing the perpetrator, in my view. We have seen progress, and there on some fronts in some places, but it seems to be very localised in Britain. I mean, Northumbria, for example, their police, they've been working on training the frontline officers and it basically to think, is it stalking? If not, is it harassment? And so on, rather than going the other way. They're one of the forces that's removed pins from use. And they've actually used some of our testimony on their training videos that they're rolling out to all their frontline forces. Some of the forces are reacting to this. Some areas have good multi-agency responses, and we were talking to a couple of guys in Cheshire just recently. And Dan and Dave, and it's a detective constable, Dave Thompson, and Dan Jones, who's a forensic psychologist, and they've set up a stalking unit in Cheshire. And the idea is that with their combined expertise and with the other multi-agencies involved, that when a case comes to them, they can they have the expertise to manage the risk urgently and in the best possible way. Best practice like that needs to be developed and shared around. And that's something that everyone is trying to do in this year's Stalking Awareness Week, in fact, and trying to promote this best practice and spread.
Now, that comes down to, Clive, to leadership, which is one of my favourite and key areas that I like to talk about, because leadership is the most important thing when we're talking about keeping victims safe. And if a chief officer believes that it's a priority and says that it's important, then there will be investment in units like Dave Thomason's in Cheshire. Now, Dave's been an expert working with me for many years. And, you know, we've been trying to ensure that pins are done away with. I think there's about five forces now who no longer use them as the go-to in stalking cases. And there are centres of expertise, and Paladin having the trained advocates, and there are many around the country as well, specialist advocates who can help and support and advise the victims, but also the police, so that we try and keep people safe. Because unfortunately, there was a breach of that police information notice in Alice's case, and there wasn't a robust follow-up. And asking a victim, what do you want us to do about it? Well, how would anyone understand every option that's in a criminal justice system available to a police officer? They are not an expert, but an advocate can be there to help them navigate through the criminal justice system and the civil justice system. But make sure that the police in particular focus on the perpetrator and put them at the centre of the investigation, because
it's a key issue. I mean, and the other key issue, I think, for us that complements that is the fact that the victim won't recognise what danger they're in. We have to kind of try and raise awareness. The point is that even when the advocates are there, people have to realise that they need them. They have to approach Paladin, they have to approach the helplines or whatever to know that they need this advocacy. And that's where I think people like us can maybe help, that to trying to just sort of spread the message, tell the story. And maybe what we're trying to do in the biggest way is just to change general attitudes about stalking. You know, stalking is still in the public perception is still a bit of a joke. You know, I'll stalk them a bit on Facebook, or you know, and stalking is dead serious. I mean, where's the word come from? Deer stalking, where does that lead? You know, that's what stalking is. And we have to get across to people, you know, that and it's coming mostly out of domestic situations, the follow-ups, but not just the stranger stalking that gets in the news quite often. People have to realise how serious it is, and also what some of the signs are, so that, you know, if they're being stalked, or if their friend has got issues, or maybe they're worried about their male friend, maybe he's getting to be a bit of a stalker, you know. And people have to be aware. And in a sense, maybe it's that if we can create a sort of public change of attitude where stalking is suddenly one of the serious things, you know, if there's a rape case, no one thinks twice, and the police wouldn't think twice about getting in there and doing something about it. We have to kind of get the same mental attitude amongst everyone towards stalking, I think.
To see it as something that's serious. And that's why creating the criminal offence of stalking was to ensure that professionals took it seriously and that there was training. And, you know, we continue to roll out training. And the other point, Clive, that you mentioned and we've talked about a lot, is that he was a serial perpetrator. Harry had done this to multiple girls and women. And of course, Alice didn't know about this, did she? And, you know, the police should have actually searched their indices to look at history of the perpetrator. And we see this time and time again when they don't, because they don't see it as serious. And that's why we've been working together, and you and Sue have joined us in the campaign to lobby the Home Office to bring in the register for serial perpetrators of domestic violence and stalkers.
Yeah, we have to have joined up databases. First of all, people have to, and the police have, or whoever is approached, it might be different agencies approach, has to recognise that it may be stalking and then join the dots, and the information has to be there so that they can join those dots, and then they have to work from that end. And you know, too often in the past, you know, if there's a single offence, you know, someone may break into someone's house or do a bit of criminal damage or something. Or, of course, they may do something trivial, like leaving a load of flowers on the windowsill. Do you remember the Cadbury's milk tray advert? Chocolates on the window. How romantic is that? Well, it, you know,
it's freaking creepy behaviour. That's not romantic in this situation.
It's not in this sort of situation. It's super scary. Have to train to recognise that if that's part of a stalking campaign, you don't concentrate on the one offence. You have to concentrate on the bigger picture.
The pattern of behaviour. Absolutely.
Clive, you mentioned how Alice was so polite in the calls, and I noticed that she must have gotten that from you. I mean, you have every right in the world to be outraged and furious at the offender and at the system that failed your daughter Alice and your family, and yet you have this poise and calm and civility about it. And I think I'm congratulating you on that, because I think that's going to help, you know, working with organizations like Paladin and Laura, and it's going to help make change happen so that people don't have to sort of wade through all the emotion. You're stating facts that need to change, facts that should have been in place already. And I really hope that with your advocacy and Laura's and Paladin's and ours, that we can actually help affect that change. Of course, the UK is far ahead of the United States in this area, and we need to really ensure that that same kind of behavior is illegalized here, coercive control, for example, and actually that people take it seriously and don't think that a piece of paper can actually protect the victim, when in fact it can exacerbate the situation and cause a victim to.
No, thank you for that. I mean, the key question for us is, if another Alice came to the police today, would the outcome be any different? And, you know, everything that I do, that we do, that you're doing, is really going for that goal. And, yeah, you encourage me. And that's what we're living for now. So that's what we're doing.
Well, you inspire me, Clive, you and Sue and meeting Nick. You inspire me to be better at what we do. And I know the Real Crime Profile team, Lisa and Jim, felt very strongly about raising awareness around stalking, as we do in all of our podcasts, but in particular this one, for National Stalking Awareness Week. And we always say, if we make one difference to one victim's life, one person's life, you know, then it's worthwhile.
And it's worth it. That's absolutely right.
And I know that just telling Alice's story is helping people. I know we have so many listeners who write to us saying that they know somebody in their lives who are being stalked just the way Alice is, but they don't even recognize that they're victims. They just don't see it, and it's so scary and frustrating. And in fact, the victim sees it as being almost romantic, that the stalking, you know, the chocolates, and they see it as this lovesickness, and they don't see it as the threat. So, you know, I'm going to post the documentary that you mentioned, An Hour to Catch a Killer, on our Facebook page, and just telling her story over and over again. I know probably has already saved somebody. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. And yeah, we're all going in the same direction here. And we've, you know, sadly, we found out that telling the story is empowering, because, you know, especially talking to audiences and police or whatever, you know, if I'm combining forces with some of the professionals who are then coming with the statistics and the possible solutions and so on. But telling the story, personalizing it, working together with those, that adds power and punch, and hopefully helps all the more to actually get the change we all want.
Sure, it does.
It really does. Thank you so much for your time, Clive. And we're conscious that you have something that you need to get to now,
yes,
at dinner.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
All right.
Bye.
With hindsight, there are many signs of stalking and coercive behaviour that we did not recognise. Everyone should know about these signs. This is National Stalking Awareness Week, and we feel there is a need for much more work to be done to publicise and identify stalking and controlling behaviour, to tackle the root causes and to stop them developing out of control. We all hope to do as much as we can from now on, both on our own and in collaboration with the organisations such as the Susie Lamplew Trust and Women's Aid, to learn lessons, to raise awareness, and ultimately, as we all sincerely hope, to help prevent what happened to Alice happening to others. Thank you.
The fact that Clive did come to our first National Best Practice Conference, you know, it was something that was important to the family. In fact, all of them came along to the conference, and Clive stood up and did the keynote address. Yeah. And I've spoken to him numerous times before that. And I've got to say, it's just so powerful when he talks about Alice, and certainly when they did the documentary, the ITV's An Hour to Catch a Killer. Well, they didn't know all the history. They didn't know about all of the calls to police, and they didn't know about the police response.
Oh, wow.
And so their journey has changed over time. Of, you know, there's no criticism of the police at all in terms of their investigation of the murder. And actually, the police are very good at those cases. But it's the early identification, intervention, and prevention prior.
Prevention should be more important.
Exactly. So this case was referred to the Independence Police Complaints Commission, along with hundreds of others that I've reviewed and collected over the years. And actually, Jim and Lisa, I have to say it's the same lessons repeating over and over again. This isn't new stuff, sadly. And it's about ensuring that people do ask those right questions. And they ask the right questions about risk. Because as you heard from Clive, I mean, Alice was fearful. She was scared of him. He was turning up unannounced more than three times a week. We say that that's a marker of high risk. He was sending chocolates, flowers. He called in excess of 290 times. He was threatening her. He made threats to kill. Now, we know that if someone's been intimate and they make a threat to kill, one in two of them will act on
it.
Right,
exactly.
And it was escalating. And this was stalking. This was coercive control. So I'm already counting like 10 high risks.
But why didn't the police ask those questions of her? I mean, I've listened to the tapes. And it is so sad. You can hear the fear in her voice. But she is being polite. And the police officer seems like he's helpful.
Yeah, he's trying to be gentle with her.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. He's trying to, you know, suggest things. Although the suggestions turn out to be not really, they turn out to be hollow. And you know, she couldn't go get a solicitor and file some civil case against this guy and all that. But that's not what it's about. It should have been about, this is criminal activity. He mentions this is harassment. He mentions it to her. That's a crime. So why didn't he then say, okay, I'll send somebody out there immediately. You know, this is a crime. We will investigate and charge him. You know, that's what should have happened.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the standard operating protocol, the best practice. But actually, this is 2016, remember? October the 12th, 2016. He should have been saying, this is stalking. Can I ask you 12 questions about the behaviour and then start off asking the stalking specific questions? But stalking wasn't mentioned. Now, this was 3 months after the breakup, bear in mind, that he is behaving in this way. And so the right things, he was trying to reassure her, as you said, but actually in stalking cases, that's not really the job of the police officer. The job is to get to the risk and is there a crime and to understand what's going on. And yet none of those right questions were asked. And Alice was. I mean, you hear on at the end of that call, she starts crying. Mm-hmm. And you hear, you know, when I hear victims cry like that, it's the initial part of trying to get across what's going on to someone and then kind of the almost like relief, someone's taking it seriously. But what she also said to her sister was that he would end up killing her before the police took it seriously. She said that to Emma, and she felt that she was being palmed off by the police because they weren't saying, we're going to come to your address. In fact, the second call where he's breached, they actually say, well, we can't really do anything until Sunday.
Right. Oh, no, there's no appointments left. So we'll have to make it Sunday or
right.
Monday.
Like she's going to the dentist or she's booking an appointment with somebody, you know, in the workplace, not that she's at risk and that this guy has breached the police information notice. It's an arrestable offence. And they're not asking any of the follow-up questions about
stalking. Do you think it's just that he had not been trained? He did not know? He did not have any idea that this was a really serious situation?
It's so difficult, as you know, to know what's going on in an officer's head. But, you know, have they been living under a rock for the past, you know, they don't read the newspapers, they don't realise it's National Stalking Awareness Week every week. every year, I should say, since 2011. They don't read any of the police notices or the fact that there's been specialist training rolled out via the College of Policing, via Paladin, even when, you know, we do all the media in Paladin and different cases. So there's some part that's a responsibility of police training, but there's the other of being, you know, aware of what's also going on in the media, but not to mention stalking once. And for me, the biggest disappointment, this is October, the 12th, 2016, we're not talking about 5 years ago. This current best practice that we have at Paladin, it is important. You know, I've hosted best practice conferences where we've paid for police to attend and the Crown Prosecution Service and for key agencies. We want them in the room. But this is where, again, it comes back to leadership, because if the leaders don't see it as important, then guess what? It doesn't get investment, it doesn't get prioritized, and it doesn't get done.
Well, a couple of things that made me think of, like, maybe the police think, well, this just doesn't happen here, like that this happens other places, but, you know, it can't possibly be this serious. And the other thing is, you know, as a woman, what are you supposed to do? You're kind of damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Here she is trying to articulate what's happening to her in a very, you know, kind of calm, cogent way to the police. So the flip side is she's freaking out and she's hysterical, and then she's accused of being crazy. You know, she's accused of being crazy and taking it over the top because he's given her chocolates and flowers. I mean, there is no right way to behave.
And that's, you know, one of the challenges. And that's why specialist advocates are so important in this. The trained professional who can be the voice of the victim. Now, you heard Clive say, you know, the sea change, which I've been pushing for and we talk about on RCP all the time, is the victim's voice and putting the victim's voice at the center. But that doesn't mean to say we put the victim at the center of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And so still the culture, Jim, unfortunately, is that they're not asking the right questions of the perpetrator. You know, you've got someone here who's exerting power and control dynamics. You've got someone here who kind of takes on the police and takes on a lawyer at court, someone who's changing his story to fit the facts. And, you know, he is a psychopath, and yet people don't see him for the dangerous perpetrator he is. And that's the cultural shift of why we've been pushing for the register, so that it puts the onus on the perpetrator and not on the victim. But that's not about the believing the victim part. Believing the victim, taking them seriously, of course, is critical. But here you had so many behaviours. You had so many things happening for poor Alice and her trying to start a new relationship with Mike. And I remember Sue and Clive just talking about this behavioural change in Alice, of going from this gregarious, sort of fun, prankster, loving, you know, young woman to just losing her confidence completely, and him really closing down her space. And there were so many opportunities, sadly, for the police to close down his space. But it's only at the point of the murder where they get everything right. And
right.
Yes, the DCI, the Detective Chief Inspector, as you will see, in An Hour to Catch the Killer, it's a fairly straightforward case, incidentally, because they know who it is, and it's a case of putting all the things in place in terms of the investigative strategy. But the harder part is trying to keep victims alive. That's where money, time and investment and training should really be happening, in my humble opinion.
Absolutely. I mean, number one topic that our listeners write to us about are people that they're worried about in their lives that are being stalked or coercively controlled. I mean, we get this every single week, sometimes every day, letters like this. And it's just a huge, huge issue out there. And so many times the victims, they don't see themselves as victims. And I don't know what we can do to change that. I don't.
Well, raising awareness is one of those things. I mean, I remember talking to Tricia Bunnell, the mother of Claire Bunnell, who was stalked and murdered in Harvey Nichols, sadly, after she just had a couple of dates with a guy who worked there at the Harvey Nichols store. And she was stalked and murdered on September the 13th, 2005, 20 minutes before she was due to clock off work. And he went in through a side door after being sacked from work because of his behaviour to Claire. And he shot her in the back of the head and also in the face multiple times. And I remember Tricia saying to me, I mean, exactly as Clive said about that door knock, for one, the police coming round, and she just knew instantly in her stomach that something terrible had happened to Claire. And she was desperate to find out, well, what did the police do? And I was working in the Metropolitan Police Service at that time. What did the police do to protect her daughter? And these are questions that are quite right to ask. And, you know, sadly, I reviewed that particular case. And there were multiple things that she had Claire had reported to police. And again, the stalking wasn't understood. Now, this was in 2005, and this was really the thing that spurred me on, working with Tricia Claire's mum and Carol Faruqi, whose daughter Rana was stalked and murdered in 2003. Those mothers really inspired me to create change. And that's where the National Stalking Helpline came from in 2010. It's where National Stalking Awareness Week came from in 2011. It's where we campaigned for the stalking crime in 2012. It's why we set up Paladin in 2013. It's why we've been rolling out best practice across the last couple of years. And I still remember Tricia saying this to me very clearly, was that when Claire was saying that she was scared of him and he was saying that he loved her and that he had threatened her and threatened to kill her, we as a family thought, well, that doesn't happen to people in Tunbridge Wells. That happens, you know, murder happens to people in the newspapers, not people like us. Now, Clive and Sue said very similarly, because people don't think those things happen to them. So, you know, my plea really is, if you are concerned about someone, if you do have concerns for yourself of somebody's behaviour towards you, please, at the very least, just Google Paladin's website and have a look at the warning signs on there and the advice that we give to victims, and to tell someone what's happening. You know, if you're a mother or a father or a son, a cousin, a best friend, please just take the time to sit down with your loved one and go through the risk factors in particular, because that very action in and of itself could save someone's life. And if you do go to the police and you don't get the desired response, well, again, contact Paladin. There are other people who can be your voice and be champions for you. And this is, again, why it's critical for us to have a service like Paladin in the US for the 7 million people who are being stalked here. It's not just about domestic violence and relationships. We know it happens to people who are not in relationships, because that can be the whole point of stalking. Someone wants the relationship with someone. So, and these are very dangerous cases.
Yes, obviously.
Well, every time speaking out, and that's why National Stalking Awareness Week is an important week to highlight different aspects to it, whether it's about perpetrator intervention and management, whether it's about risk assessment, whether it's about best practice for the police investigation. You know, the psychology of stalking is something that there's a lot of work currently being undertaken on, both in Australia, in America, in the UK, and our knowledge is advancing. But I really don't want to keep looking at families and interacting with them and looking at them as we have just done in the whites of the eyes of a father whose world fell apart because his daughter was polite and acquiesced, and because the police didn't understand the risks and the dangers of this very insidious crime called stalking. Her name was Alice. We'll be putting out the link to the documentary, and in our show notes also the link to Paladin and the risk assessments. And we no doubt will be talking about stalking and coercive control in other podcasts. So thank you very much for listening. This is Real Crime Profile, signing out.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.